It is just past 18 hours, 32 minutes and 15 seconds East African time. Time for John Sibi Okumu on Wednesday. This being Wednesday, the 19th of April, 2023. Hamjambo na karibuni. Hello and welcome. Abstraction, a la prima, allegory, appropriation, avant-garde, baroque, brushwork, chiaroscuro, color theory, composition, contrapposto, distortion, figurative, genre, glazing, impressionism, mixed media, motif, narrative, perspective, photorealism, plein air, proportion, realism, renaissance, scale, sfumato, symbolism, texture, theme, trompe-l'œil, underpainting, value. Those are just some of the terms that would serve to describe visual art in the Western tradition. My expectation is that our mystery guest until the end in this edition, an art historian by academic training, will enlighten us as to their relevance, if any, in Kenya since our independence in 1963, and indeed much before that. A guest in point, because as you listen, you are sure to be disabused of the thinking that all young Kenyans everywhere know little about their past or their culture. But first, let's hear a sample of answers to the question, have you bought artwork to put in your home? Je, ushawahi kununua kifaa cha usanii ili ukitumie kama pambo la nyumba yako?
I have a drive canvas. I have really loved to have more. Another inhibiting factor is the price associated with it, because it's way out of reach. I think it's a bit expensive for budget of Kenyan.
I don't have an interest.
I have no money, and I have no good house to buy this.
I have not come across any.
Most of them are from a friend. A friend does paintings. And there's some bottle art, I don't know what they call it. They use strings and lights.
I'm super interested maybe in hizo art.
Mwanangu mtaalamu, what do you think?
Well, I commiserate with the first speaker, and I would actually agree that art is an expensive product to buy. But I'd like to point out that partly because art is an expensive product to make, art materials throughout the country are not cheap, especially if you're using traditional mediums such as oil paints, different types of paints. You have to buy the canvas, you have to buy the paints, you have to buy the thinners for the paints, you have to buy the brushes, you have to buy an easel. There's a lot of consumption to make a piece of art in and of itself. It's not a cheap product to make. I think the comment about not having a good house to put art in just, I think, shows people's perception of art as a sort of luxury item. And I think to a certain extent, they're right, you know. Traditionally speaking, you would find art in a gallery, four white walls with very highly priced artworks in them. And I think that is a legacy of our Western indoctrination when it comes to art making. But in saying that, I think Kenyans have expanded what art is. As we said, somebody mentioned that he found art made of bottles and strings and things. And, you know, you can make art out of anything. Many of Kenya's most famous artists use junk, scrap metal, bottle caps, you name it. So art doesn't have to be expensive per se. I think it's largely a case-by-case example.
Is it too much of a silly question to ask you, what is art?
No, I think the most obvious answer would be art is the product of the artist. I think a better question would be, what does an artist do?
Oh, well, okay. Gosh, that's wonderful. You're asking the questions on my behalf. The better question, what does the artist do, pray?
Well, all artists draw from their imagination. You're putting your imagination onto paper or onto stone or onto wood if it's a sculpture. It is, first and foremost, I think, a work of imagination. It's you as the artist bringing your imagination to the fore in a product which you can share with others and sell. Hopefully. I think that's the most fundamental descriptor of what art is. Secondly, I think art is used as a medium to describe values, be it personal values or the values of a society, which is why different societies have different forms of art. I think those are the two most important
things. Those are the two most important things. I'd like to draw you on this idea, maybe, that we in Kenya are the poor cousins of the international artistic community, and especially with regard to the notion of being 60 years old, do we have any art history to speak of, and would you draw us on that particular?
I think we have a very rich art history, especially in the last 60 years, I would say. I think it may not appear rich because it isn't common knowledge and it isn't widely disseminated. The information has not been brought to the vox populi, so to speak. Kenya has always had players on the world art scene since the beginning. Since 60 years ago, there have been Kenyan artists who have made a name for themselves on the world stage.
I'd like you to go back to before, because I'm sure there was art before independence. So for us to sort of peg it to 1963 is a failing on my part.
True.
I'd like you to go back to the, what are they called? Is it the mists of time or maybe the fogs?
The depths of time.
Perhaps. The depths, whichever. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I think, look, one has to understand that our forms of art making underwent a very serious transformation during and after the colonial period. The art that you see now would not have been present at that time, just for the reason that the Western influences were not present at that time. So take painting, for example. Painting in mediums of oil and watercolor. These things were not common, were not found in our pre-colonial societies. And in the past, many scholars have said, therefore, that we didn't have any art and that we were too savage to make art and so on and so forth. But I think that's not true. I think we just manifested our artistic tastes in different mediums. So performance, bodily performance in choruses, singing, communities like the Kamba and the Kisi have sculptural traditions in stone and in wood. So it was a very different form of art prior to the colonial period. What we know now is largely influenced by that encounter. Much of what we now see as art comes from that encounter because these forms and these mediums were brought to us.
Maybe there's an element of shame in that admission. I'll tell you about a recent production that I went to see of a Ngugi wa Thiong'o play. They were doing Gaika Deda, I'll Marry When I Want, and it's not the only one. They came to the point where the traditional dancers had sort of modern interpretation. They were all dressed in blue. All of a sudden, their costumes could have been done by Yves Saint Laurent. And there they were. These were traditional. But we go to the specter of a lady who came to this country in 1937 by the name of Joy Adamson. And in our state house, in our national house to invite every visiting head of state, we have these pictures that sort of depict Igembe sorcerer, Kalenjin masked raider with his... and that is it. Now, you, as the Americans would say, you see where I'm going with this. Nothing was there before this, well, she wasn't English, but this European woman decided to put it on canvas.
Mm.
And then that's all we had to show for it. Because if you're telling the truth, there ought to be something else in State House that goes back further, that was dug up in Olagasaili or something, but there isn't.
Mm. I think that's largely a hangover from, again, that same colonial period. One has to understand that these mediums, these forms of art, these methods of expression were explicitly demonized by the colonial regime at the time. I mean, if you think back to the Christianizing mission, so let's say before 1890 or something, there's records of various performance pieces to do with our traditions. So Kikuyus used to have dancing associated with beer drinking, for example. Here comes a priest, whether from the ACK or the Catholic Church, and says, okay, this is sinful demon worship. You better stop, you know, these choral performances talking about how nice beer is. So it's largely a hangover from that. What happened was a lot of our traditional forms were destroyed and supplanted with the aesthetic forms of the West. You know, even Kenyatta talked about how he was taught how to be a sculptor and how to be a carpenter along European lines. So I think we are still dealing with that fallout now, and that's why Joy Adamson's, you know, paintings of Kenyans in their skins is seen as a higher product of civilization compared to our traditional forms.
But if you would, I draw you on this business. Let's stay with this image slightly more. Is there an element of shame that attaches to our far past? Because if we're, another thing, in the WhatsApps groups that I attend, let's put it to the present day, somebody's just died and there's a funeral somewhere. They're saying, you know, okay, we're going to send them off. Thank you for raising so much money. They're going off to heaven and flights of angels accompany them on this wonderful trip. So that's what we believe. So are we, in essence, taking off from a different point of view of negation? We are an Islamic, we are a Christian nation, and basically forget the past. Forget the past. Let's not try and say we did this. Let's just say, you know, draw a line and move on to the Baroques and the Renaissance and whatever else I mentioned.
Yes, yes, I agree. I think shame would be the right word, but I think it's important to stress the messaging behind that shame. Again, you know, I read a story about a person who was interviewed in 1967, and he was talking about how his father used to be a Nyatiti player, for example, right? When he converted to Christianity, he was told, hey, this thing you're playing is to summon demons and spirits, and if you want to see the kingdom of heaven, you better get rid of it. So this man went and burned his Nyatiti. It's quite a visceral image of a man burning his instruments, but that shows the pressure. And that shows the violence behind the messaging of you better abandon these traditions of yours if you want to see enlightenment.
But okay, but we're still sort of what is this circling this little thing? The wedding ceremony, the wedding ceremony where maybe let's pick the Kikuyu. Now the bride will come in this sort of earthen, and again it's a sort of Yves Saint Laurent design. And it's a traditional ceremony, and some minister gets married, and everybody's. But they've abandoned the sort of, you know, they haven't pierced their ears and enlarged them to an. We have this sort of schizophrenic relationship to our past.
Yes.
And we're drawing close to our first break. I'd just like you to. Are we therefore, in terms of artistic, aesthetic appreciation, are we at a point where we actually don't know what to appreciate? So if somebody comes in and fills in this vacuum, we'll be happy and say, oh my gosh, Mwanangu has bought a, I don't know, coming from some gallery in Stockholm. Do you know what I mean? Maybe I'm not expressing myself well.
I understand. I understand.
What would you say to that?
Again, I think I would say, finding intent, I think, is what you're looking for. The intent, do we feel ashamed of the past, this schizophrenic relationship you're talking about? And I would agree with you, I think we do. And I think it's a balancing act between coming to terms with the violence of that colonial period and how these forms were destroyed and how the values that you're mentioning of shame were attached to these traditions. I think there's work to be done in understanding that encounter. But I do think you're right. I do think we do have a very schizophrenic relation to our past.
Time for a break. No rest for the wicked. Capital FM. Mwanangu, let's go back to the H-word history. When did you mentioned the Kamba carvers, the Kisi soapstone. When on the timeline did this begin?
It varies, honestly, from art form to art form, from community to community. I mean, the Akamba soapstone industry, or art form, or whatever you want to call it, is thousands of years old. You can dig up artifacts, be it pipes or any sort of artifact in stone, dating back thousands and thousands of years, using the same materials from the same place. The Akamba sculpture is more interesting because the industry, or the, again, the art form or the medium, whatever you want to call it, can roughly be credited to one person in the 1920s by the name of Mutesi Amunge, who lived in a village called Wamunyu, where people still sculpt the things he introduced to this day. And so it really, it varies from community to community.
So 1920?
Yes.
Who taught Mutesia, who gave him the inspiration to carve? I'm sorry, I'm afraid I'm not familiar with his work, but maybe that's why we're here. We'll go and look for it.
Well, let me jog your memory. Do you have any recollection of those Askari figurines?
Oh, yes, indeed.
In the 50s and 60s.
Well, Askaris, yes, yes. Sort of with a little, you know, but not proportional.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yes. That's a good point. I think he began that aesthetic of sculpture. So Mutesi Amunge was, again, a young Akamba man who was drafted in the King's African Rifles. While he was a soldier, you know, all soldiers have leisure time, downtime. In his downtime, he took to sculpting figurines. And what did he sculpt? He sculpted his surroundings, his fellow soldiers, you know, in their uniforms, in their Askari uniforms of the King's African Rifles. And along come his Mzungu supervisors and say, actually, these are very attractive little figurines. How much would you sell them for? And so Mutesia, being an enterprising Kenyan, went home to Wamunyu and said, actually, we can sell these things on the tourist market. And that was the beginning in the late 20s, 1930s of that form of sculpture, which we're all so familiar with, the little Kamba yes. wooden figurines.
So what's the trajectory, between that Mutesia and Kioko Mwitiki? Now, for those listening, Kioko Mwitiki is the guy who did us huge sort of elephants outside Nakumat in the great heyday of Nakumat. And I know that because I know him personally, that he gets onto a plane and goes to London, Paris, New York. What is the growth that has occurred in the interim?
Let me try and make a long story short. Well, look, I think with all artistic movements, you're talking about influences over time from different parts of the world. So, you know, at the beginning, Mutesi Amunge was influenced in the proportions of his sculpture by Zaramo carvers out of Tanzania when he was in the army. So that is the first movement. The second movement would be the introduction of Makonde sculptures, again from Tanzania. You know those sculptures with
yes,
the
indeed.
Black.
Yes, yes.
Makonde sculptures came into Nairobi to sell these works, and again, Kenyan sculptors picked it up. The third movement, where you get to the Kioko Mutikis, is again the large availability of scrap metal and new mediums, new sources of welding, new technologies from the 1970s onwards. People figuring out they can actually make art out of scrap metal. So again, different technologies are available to you across time. And so that's the difference between someone like Mutesi Amunge and Kioko, is different.
That's of interest to me, because if we all those fancy terms that we had at the beginning,
yes,
is there a call here for some form of education?
Yes,
going off to the Slade School of Art in London, and you're coming out as David Hockney,
yes,
because you've learnt the stuff. Or is it again maybe the way we were told that we played rugby, sort of instinctively? We took the ball and ran like dicks across the field. Are we doing this art because we have some kind of tradition upon which we're leaning? Or is it because my kid likes scrap metal, let him see if he can make a bird? Should we go to school? Have we gone to school? Is there a school?
You don't need to go to school to be an artist.
Ooh.
That's
a theoretical statement. Will you survive this until next dinner time?
I hope so.
Expand.
Some of our most successful contemporary artists never went to art school a day in their lives.
That's not the question I'm asking. I'm asking whether it's a necessary component to take your kid on a four-year course to study art.
No, I think only if your kid is interested in the academic side of art, not in art making. That would be my take. Again, if you look at as far as I know, with someone like Kyoko, he didn't exactly go to an art institute. As far as I know, I could be wrong. I'm open to correction. But if you look again, some of our most prolific sculptors, someone like Cyrus Kabiru, has never been to school to my knowledge, and many of his contemporaries have not. But again, you don't have to go to school to draw on the work of your contemporaries. You're working with them. You see them every day in your life. Again, as I mentioned, these are scary figurines. All of us, it's in our collective memory. We've seen those sculptures. We can draw inspiration from them. It's not quite necessary to go to school and have slides and PowerPoints to follow tradition.
I'd like to draw you on this idea of appropriation from another angle. We've evoked Joy Adamson, but we could also evoke this idea of ethnicity and therefore going across to the creative field, the way you would say, I'm a Mkamba, therefore these figurines are ours. I am a Kikuyu, therefore any perception of Mount Kenya ought to be taken by me. I am an African, and therefore my painting of the elephant is the most valid, and you're just a Mzungu, white Kenyan who came here, third generation. You have no right to go and draw the elephant with all its wrinkles. So again, comment. I'm trying to suggest, let me be more succinct, that we're not talking yet of a national pride in the output. We're taking, first of all, an individual pride. Then after I've succeeded, all my people say, hey, JSO, he's one of us. And then it stretches until, if you're lucky, you become Eliud Kipchoge.
Well, I hope it's not too controversial a statement, but I think that depends largely on which rung of Kenyan society you belong to. I think your statement would be more true outside of the metropolis that is Nairobi, say in somewhere like Kisumu or Murang'a Town. I think you're right. But again, the art that we see, go back to Kamba sculptures, for example, or even Makonde sculpture, for that matter. Makonde sculpture is not necessarily made by people who are Makonde. The Makonde come from Tanzania, and yet we see Kenyans making their aesthetic of sculpture. A lot of the Kamba sculptures in the collectives in Mombasa are certainly not Kambas. Many of them are Kikuyus. And I generally believe that appropriation is an inevitable consequence of globalization, as our old boundaries and borders get taken away by the need to come to the big city and find jobs. It's inevitable. It's going to happen. Cultures are going to mix and intermingle. And I think that is how you forge a national pride and national identity.
So it's a good thing.
I believe so.
I believe that the argument in the West is that it's a bad thing. You know, white woman writes about, you know, African Americans in Harlem, and nobody buys the book. So once again, is the West ahead of us? Are we heading there? We haven't got you're being very sort of accommodating, but you know, the Civil War is yet to come.
I think we'd be foolish if we looked to the West to guide us on our trajectories, especially with art. Our society, the makeup of our society is the heterogeneity. The diversity of our societies is
indeed
nowhere near. That would be my take. I think we should go along our own trajectories and paths.
Okay, we go back to an image. I'm trying to have the images of the man in the street. Mm. We've got our bangles. Everybody's very keen now to be Kenyan. And I've got one at home. I'm not wearing it in the studio. But you know the bangles with our Kenyan colors and our there's some which include Kenya, Uganda, the whole thing. This idea, this yearning for a regional cohesion, which is being led by the artist. Do you think that is a role, this messianic role of bringing people together, is one of the functions of the artist in a society?
I believe so. I think, again, artists function as carriers of a society's value. You know, if you look to go back to, you know, the worst period in our history, 2007.
Post-election violence.
That's the one.
Right.
Artists were integral in bringing people together. You look at the work of Masai Mbili and Kibera of fostering peace and intertribal relations. I think the role of the artist can fall under those terms of peacekeeping and peacemaking. If you look at who honors our heroes, our national heroes, it's the sculptors, you know, the Kevin Odwors who made sculptures in Uhuru Park honoring Dedan Kimathi and all our other Mau Mau stalwarts. I think the artist fulfills that role, I believe.
Okay, just before the break, I want a definition, then we'll come back to it. In my research, I found out two things. Well, that genre has got to do about, genre doesn't mean like literary genre, it's got about still life. But here's value, the lightness or darkness of a color or hue. Many artists argue that value is the most important aspect of a realistic painting. It's more important than color itself. So for you, as an art historian, that's a different kind of value. But I would like you to say how we attach the bangle with the Kenya colors to the pricing that you'd give to your own work. An initial definition to allow me time to think, and then have some comeback for you when we come back.
I think the value and pricing of an art is the message it portrays and how that message is visually portrayed. I think that's the value to me off the bat of an artwork.
Time for a break. Thank you so much. Capital FM. Mwanangu, chums, money.
Yes.
Remember that that answer that says, it's too expensive for me. I cannot afford this, shall we call it stuff, for lack of a wide vocabulary.
Mm.
How are we going to price it? And I want us to go to this idea, because in a conversation such as ours, I want you to see where it might lead. Because the index of success is to find yourself being sold, representing Kenya at the Biennale in Venice, or being, what is that lady's name? Mutu?
Wangeshi Mutu, yes.
Wangeshi Mutu. We all want to be doing what she's doing. We all want to be Magdalene Odundo with our, you know, Dame Magdalene Odundo. We're no longer, we've got British citizenship because of our wonderful clay pots. Mm-hmm. Tell the young man in Kibra or Kaungwari or slums, wherever they exist, how they might end up being these people. Starting off with attaching value to them at home. The V word, cost.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, look, to start off, what the artwork has to be attractive to the consumer. That's the basic starting point. You have, if you're an artist, you need to make work that is innovative, that is attractive, and that is authentic. And for many artists, that sounds easier than it is in real life. But that's the basis. You have to make something that is good to look at, that you enjoy taking in. Again, art is one of the few products where the price is dependent on the context of where this artwork is exhibited, the context that surrounds it. I wrote an article about the importance of curating an artwork. I saw an exhibition where a bunch of really high quality photographs were curated rather poorly and, you know, put on an iron grate, and it just looked shoddy, to be honest. And you're not going to fetch a price. You're not going to fetch a good price for your artwork unless you curate it properly, unless you curate it as a valuable item. Off the bat, I would say those are the most important pricing factors. Context is everything with the work, and you have to own the context.
So, sorry, are you saying in a way that we're sort of, when we're doing deals with the person at the Maasai market, and saying chukua shilingi shirini for this because it's being curated, but there's no middleman. I think I've I'm doing quite well if I've got my sort of wooden ladles for to serve out my vegetables, and they cost me 200 bob. Mm. So am I a rip-off merchant? Am I a bad person for aiming for 200 shillings as opposed to 200,000 shillings?
Well, let me put it like this way. In the West, there was an artist who, and I'm not making this up, went into a gallery and exhibited a bunch of bananas. That artwork is going for millions of dollars, which is unthinkable money when you translate that to shillings. Now, what's the difference between those marigots in that gallery and the marigots that are sold on the streets? Again, the context that's around it. So-and-so is a famous artist. So-and-so has connections in the art world. He knows all the gallery owners. He has a clientele. And therefore, bananas are going for millions of dollars. Now,
So you're suggesting that creativity and remuneration, there is no objective route to find a Picasso in our society. We're all going to draw Guernica. You know, there's a cow, he's facing up there, you know, he's being trodden on. Draw a cockerel with the one feather missing. I say, this guy's a genius. Where we all know what a chicken looks like. Exactly. We all know what a bull looks like. Precisely. So I'm not impressed, mm-hmm. because I want to, in any other field, Mwanangu, mm. there is the idea of objective, tangible skill possessed by the surgeon, possessed by the astronaut going off to Mars. And you're saying the artist, we just wing it until you get the good curator?
That's not what I'm saying at all. Well, I do see your point.
Put it another way.
I do see your point. Look, as I said at the beginning, you have to be innovative and you have to be skillful, and your work has to be intriguing and pleasing to look at. That's step one. Outside of that, really, as an artist, that's really all you can do to start. You know, I will be honest and say, it takes a while for any artist to get the recognition they feel they deserve, because the artwork is not the end product. It's the experience of going to, again, a gallery or an event or an opening and seeing what so-and-so made for such event. That's why people go to galleries. Art would not fetch the same price in a gallery than it would in a kiosk, is the point I'm making. So I'm phrasing this answer from, what can the artist control? Number one, social media is your friend. Get your work out there. Put your work out for people to see. That's the best head start you'll do. Once you have an audience who wants your product, you can then raise the price based on demand. That, and again, making your artwork attractive, intriguing, and authentic is really all the artist can do, is the point I'm making.
Yes, and is another criterion here, in much the same way that if you hear somebody singing,
yes,
you know,
precisely,
opera, and it's sort of Montserrat Caballé or something, local, let's localize it. Mm. Because in the same school, the same boarding school, was one Mr. Gakunju Kaigwa. He was my junior by years undefined. But what we gathered when he grew up to do whatever he was doing is that when you saw Gakunju's work, you realize that basically you couldn't do it yourself.
Precisely. Yes. And
so is that a criteria?
Absolutely. And that's why,
you know, his ladles and whatever, he's done a few, but I couldn't go and get some mahogany and do the same thing. Mm. So uniqueness.
Yeah. And personal authenticity. When Billy Kaigwa was a good example with that sculpture in the mall, right?
Yes.
Those who were there, I mean, I'm not even sure if I was born, not to show my age, but those who were there would have seen that sculpture in the mall and be like, who on earth did this?
Yes.
Knowing that very few could do this. So yes, that's, you're right in saying uniqueness. I guess maybe authenticity is the wrong word I use, but as an artist, you need to have your signature. You need to do something that nobody else can do. You need to be unique in your aesthetic expression.
Right. Naming and shaming time. The understanding is that when you, the idea of the middleman, you talked about the person who's, the idea of people who are middlemen know where this art is going to find a market and are busy sourcing it, as you said, for, you know, the lesser, the kanga, which is being sold for 5 shillings here And then when it finds itself to Holland, it's already become, you know, 5,000 guilders or whatever the money can be. Is there any kind of legislation that is going to make the world a fairer place for the visual artist? And this is a problem that's going to stretch with artificial intelligence. Nobody's quite in control. You know, I can attach a wonderful canvas to myself, apparently thought out by a robot.
Yeah, you're right. I think it is somewhat of a ticking time bomb, especially to my knowledge, AI. If not regulated, we'll put a lot of artists out of business.
But there were human beings before the AI. That was step number three. That was the what about the middle man or woman who takes, you know, the person who makes sure that I end up at the Biennale?
Yeah, I think a good word
for the owners of art galleries.
Yes.
Are they good people? Are they bad people? Should we love them because they're God's children? What is happening?
I know many artists who certainly don't love them, that's for sure. I mean, look, I think gallery owners run a business. The middlemen are middlemen because they are facilitating a very profitable trade. How it works, if you're an artist and you go to exhibit at any gallery, I'm not going to name names because I'm an artist.
No, don't.
And I value my trade.
Only name our heroes. Washuja, Wetu.
But I think, you know, they take a commission off your work as basically rent for keeping your work in their gallery.
Right. So let's do it. Art gallery for dummies.
Yes.
I want to sell a painting for 1,000 bob.
Yes.
The gallery owner takes how much?
Depends on the gallery. Some take as much as 50%.
Right.
And some take as little as 15 to 20.
Right. So you've got to find a gallery on your way to the top which will allow you to pay your own rent once you've sold, let's say, three tableaus from an exhibition. You're doing the maths. You know what your rent is.
Yes.
You know that, you know, Kangwari Square 2, I've got to come up with 4,000 bob.
Yeah. Again, what usually happens is the more successful, the more high profile, the more exposure an artist has, the commission becomes less of a problem. If you're selling a work for ₸1,000,000 and you add 50% on top of that ₸1,000,000, it's not necessarily a problem. But yeah, I think, again, this is why I say Kenyans are getting savvy to this and finding other avenues of showing their art, most notably social media, YouTube, Instagram, wherever. The gallery, before the rise of technology, was the only arena where you could be respected as an artist and show your work for high prices. That's not so much the case now.
Let's go back to the retrospective, looking back 60 years. This idea of, have we moved forward? We've got all these sort of, I call them Joe Kadenge type stories, where the idea is that the artist dies poor. So again, all the names that we've said, in his final days, he was selling a tableau so that he could buy his blood pressure medicines. It's true. So what have we done? Every artist whom I've known intimately has had a hard luck story to tell, as a generalization.
I think the biggest, I'll go down in scale. I think the biggest problem is art's place in our society and its marginal place in our cultural zeitgeist. We've gotten a lot better, say, from the late 90s, to my knowledge. Again, I was not born at the time. But
you're the researcher, so don't have the cop-out. We've set you up, young art historian. You must know the history.
Yes, indeed. But I think, you know, there are very many factors which lead to this marginalization of artists within our society. To my knowledge, I think...
Could you name some of them? Could you list them?
Yes.
I'm interested.
I think to me, this is a hypothesis.
And you see, the artist then doesn't just becomes the musician, becomes the poet, becomes what is our attitude to the artist?
Yes.
And what's playing against him or her?
Yes. Again, based on what findings I have found, is that there was a very real switch around the time of the death of Kenyatta and the reign of a certain Daniel Arap Moi. Now, you must keep in mind that during the times of tyranny and dictatorship in this country, the artists, the musicians, the painters, the sculptors, the playwrights especially, were some of the few people who dared to stand up to the regime. The most famous story being the one you mentioned of Gahika Deda by Goge Wa Thiong'o, who, you know, these were the few members of society who had the gall to stand up against the state and challenge them in their art, in their music, in their plays. Now, to my knowledge, they were dealt with viciously. You know, Goge left because a few nights in jail and detention under torture was enough to send him away. And I think that image of the artist as a sort of useless Vinyangariko who spends his time loafing about came from that. I think it was an act of propaganda to undermine the resistance of creatives in that time. Now, that's my hypothesis based on what I've read. So since then, engaging with art, engaging in free expression, not just art, at that time was unthinkable. You know, you were risking your life. So I believe that's where a lot of this marginalization comes from, personally.
What are you risking now, if anything? Are we into the broad sunlit uplands?
We are certainly a lot better. And I think, you know, I'm not going to sit and pretend I haven't got a few raised eyebrows from friends and relatives wondering how I'm going to feed myself as an artist. But we're better. I think people are starting to realize the value of art in our society, whereas before it had no value.
But sorry, there was a time when you talked about spirituality, belief and faith. There's still some taboo subjects that are culturally imposed.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you know, the dictator was bad, but when we say you can't depict certain types of things, it's un-African, it's un-Kenyan, it's un-Christian, it's all rolled into one. This idea of self-censorship is very much alive and well.
Yes.
We're looking, you know, before we get to the last segment, we're looking forward. Because there's still certain things that surely you and I, without sort of mentioning them in a, you know, traffic jam program, that we can't do. There are certain topics that I think as a playwright, I just wouldn't go there. I mean, I wouldn't, it's too much keyboarding.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I think those taboos and those topics change with time is my point. I think.
Okay.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. But I don't think these taboos will be the same taboos in 30 years.
But you wouldn't go so far as to say that you are witnessing the erosion of these taboos. Because then you have the peripheral, the role of the press, the role of the media, the role of social media as a opening up. You know, people are getting smarter, wiser, and realizing that the world's a big place.
And I'm not sure social media makes people wiser, but
yes.
People, again, you're right, social media has exposed us to the global world.
Yes.
And shown us that there are people with other values than our own. And these values are infiltrating our society.
Our last break. Wanangu, not much time left, but let's get a bit philosophical now. Let's get a bit patriotic. Let's become a bit international. I would like to ask you whether you think that our educational system is serving the cause of your cause, of the visual artist. Do you think that whatever program we have in place to educate our children is for the ultimate good of our entire society in terms of creating creatives?
I can only answer this question in a roundabout way, because the most significant cultural contributors, again, there's an alterity that surrounds them. They have come from outside of that system. Again, I think there was a real stasis in our art education after again, before and during that dictatorship period, in the 60s, as perhaps you might remember, African art education was a vibrant thing. If you think of Elimonjao and the foundation of Payapa as a center for art education and art philosophical discussion. And so there has been a decline since that golden era, if you will. But to my mind, I think obviously we could do a lot better. But I think the first place to start would be to educate young people about our heritage and our art history, to showcase examples of successful Kenyan artists, examples of people who have impacted society, people who have changed our society. I think that would be the first step to really create a holistic art education for Kenyans.
And would you be the person who would play a role in writing the syllabus?
Well, if...
Again, the loaded word. What's in it? What's in the box? What's in the chocolate box? What's in the chocolate box, Daddy?
Yeah. I think all it is providing context for how we got here. How the art, where the art that is made now comes from. The trajectories and the different artistic movements that have led to contemporary Kenyan art. And that's necessary. I try in my own part to show that context and try and showcase that information in whatever way I can. But I think that those stories fundamentally need to get out there.
In the same way that in literary terms, I think we've got to the point where we say, you know, get rid of Shakespeare, get rid of Dickens, waste of time. As with regard, say that in a sort of a fun-filled way. but as with regard to our art, are we going to end up with the Van Goghs and the Rembrandts and the Picassos, which is so vast? That box is so huge if you open it up. What do the Japanese do that we remember from our history books, where they sort of shut themselves in for a century and then allowed the first American gunboat to come in? Is that the approach we should adopt? Close in, if it's not made in Kenya, by Kenyans, for Kenyans, with Kenyans, it's by its nature unacceptable. And then when we've found a few more heroes, we'll say, okay, what's happening across the border?
That's certainly a radical suggestion. And I agree wholeheartedly with the intent. I am really not a fan of cross-cultural comparisons, especially with art. We don't need a Van Gogh. We have an Elimoja. We don't need a Da Vinci sculpture. We have Gakunju Kaijo. You know, we don't need to compare our own local talent to the talents of other societies. I don't see the point in it personally, other than to trace aesthetic trajectories and influences. Beyond that, I think we need to honor our own heroes before we compare them to the heroes of others.
Okay, so we're still working on this syllabus. We're honoring our own, and we're saying, gosh, it always comes up. Is this a whole thing of tribe, ethnicity? Your people are, you know, trying to find water across the desert. Mine, it's raining every single day, and you put in a maize cob and it grows. It seems to me that the people who are trying very hard just to survive are not going to produce great art. So there has to be a climate of creativity, in the same way that the novelist has to do that sort of Virginia Woolf, A Room with a View of My Own, you know. There has to be. So where are those enclaves where, even if you come from Marsabit but you're so inclined, you can find an environment which is conducive to your urge?
I would actually challenge that to a certain extent. Again, if you look at I'll use Cyrus Kabira as an example. He came to prominence from, I hope I don't get this wrong, but from Kibera slums. I think art actually thrives in places you'd least expect it. I think it thrives outside of privilege. You know, I'm friends with a man called Adam.
Yes,
go ahead.
It's not so much privilege. I was more thinking about a full stomach.
Oh, that's kind of my point. I think, you know.
If you're starving, are you going to sort of write War and Peace?
I've made some of the. It's a trope fundamentally. The idea
suffering.
Of
suffering. Okay, the idea of suffering that you've got something to fall upon. You're not just having, you know, 1,000 ice creams and King Crown burgers every night. So all your problem, you're fighting, you know, I don't know, so health problems for overeating. We're trying to say, I'm going to create. I've got to time to look around me and see that there is something worth putting on the canvas, either of beauty or of great violence or of great. And my society is not providing it. So there's going to be an elite, there's going to be an artistic elite who are going to emerge. It's not a democratic space. This space is never going to be democratic. Admit to that.
I agree. Yes. I would say to that is, again, art is a creative burden on the artist. You make art regardless. We have a surplus of artists in this country. It's somewhat of a pyramid scheme, rat race, where the very few at the top were successful. But that doesn't stop the hundreds, if not thousands, of other artists from creating. So you're right, we do need to create an environment where there is more of the pie to share among the artists. We do need to create an environment where there is publication recognition of all the art ecosystems throughout this city, throughout this country, throughout the different provinces. But again, I think artists will... One thing artists will always do is carry on creating. We are the ones who just need to get hip to what's happening. We are the ones whose attitudes have to change. Those of us who are not artists, those of us who see what's going on around us, we are the ones who need to take notice and start appreciating what's happening.
Time is not on our side. And I want your last intervention would be like this idea of to be. There was that voice that we heard at the beginning. Too much like hard work. I'm asking you, can you be an impassioned apologist for the role of art and the artist, the visual artist in your case? Do they serve a useful purpose, or should we all be leaning and encouraging our kids to adopt vocational skills, which is an argument which is in the ether somewhere?
Art
defend is... Defend your religion.
Art, like music, is food for the soul. It's not food for the stomach. Which is why I think many people with empty stomachs do not have the time to appreciate it. And fair enough, if you're on the breadline, your concern is entirely, where am I getting next bread? But there is medicine for the soul, and that is what art does. Art speaks to our minds, it speaks to our souls, it speaks to our hearts, and not our stomachs.
Who are you?
My name is Mohunyo Maina. I'm a visual artist, writer, and art historian.
Now, self-revelation is always difficult. This is not a counseling program, but what... self-revelation can you share about your journey? I've already hinted that you're young, so how did you get there?
By being an artist and loving art. It sounds cliche, but I think it's that simple. I've been drawing and painting since I was an infant. I love stories, and there are no more powerful stories to my mind than art. Art tells the best stories. So I got to where I was is simply by loving art, loving what art does for people, and loving creating it. And throughout my life, I aim to tell the stories of art itself, of what art does for society. And that's what art history is.
The exhibition that you're running now at the Kyoko Mitsugi Gallery,
yes,
is dedicated to the evils of alcohol. So were you once an alcoholic?
Well, no, I mean, I certainly wouldn't call myself one on live radio, if that's what you're asking. But
tending to?
No, I think, look, again, art is also introspective from the artist.
No, that's an why this particular exhibition? What is it? Because I know, because we met in my researches, because I went to see your exhibition. And what did you do, for example?
I went to Diani.
Yes.
And I saw just how much Kenyans at Diani were drinking. And I just thought it was worth making out about. I thought it was hysterical how many volumes of alcohol we get.
Tell us about your exhibition, just to give an idea of what inspires. I know it's an old exhibition. You did it like a long time ago. But what did you do? What did you set out to do? Can you explain it to the listener?
Yeah, I wanted to showcase drinking from an honest perspective, not sort of the usual propaganda we see in advertising and marketing, you know, all these sort of buzzwords like feel your vibe, have fun. I'm like, that's not what happens when you drink liters of alcohol. So that's what I tried to do, was make an exhibition which showcased the reality of what happens when you pour down liters of alcohol in your system. So it's meant to be satire, it's meant to be amusing, but it's also meant to ask the question, why on earth do Kenyans drink so much?
In what medium? What were you doing? Sort of, I've seen it. So I'm
yes
preaching. Or
well, it's a printmaking exhibition. So it's a series of woodcut prints. Yes. The prints vary between scenes from pubs, scenes from clubs, you know. And I also invented my own alcohol brand called Violent Delights, which is based off a Shakespeare play, Romeo and Juliet.
Right, and these violence. Yes,
that's the one.
I was Romeo once in my youth.
Yes, indeed.
So, yes. So I remember that. How does one go forward? I mean, if you did the idea going to literary workshops, people want to say like, what can we expect from you next? Another exhibition about the evils. What is the fuel that's going to ignite the next exhibition?
I like asking questions about humanity in my work. I like asking questions about human behavior, why we do the things we do. And so that's likely going to be what fuels my next show too.
Again, we talked to the society at large. Could you make an appeal to the young person to follow their rainbow? Are you beginning to regret it? Are you wishing that you were a neurosurgeon?
Absolutely not. I would rather be the best artist I can be than a bad lawyer or neurosurgeon.
Okay. It is 19 hours, 28 minutes and 35 seconds just passed. Time for us to stop. Do continue to give us feedback, hopefully positive and reassuring, on the Twitter handle at Capital FM Kenya. Or drop us a line or WhatsApp message on 0701-984-984. I've been talking about our art history, rather, to young art historian, artist and writer, Muhunyo Maina. And you've been listening to John Sibi Okumu on Wednesday. Thank you most kindly, much obliged. Until next time. The best mix of music.